Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's conversation on the morning show is important and timely. We're going to be talking about the training of those who go into the challenging field of law enforcement and what kind of training is most effective so that those that engage in this dangerous, challenging, and important work can do so as effectively and safely and properly as possible. And of course, thanks to all kinds of events and incidents and concerns, including, of course, some very, very close to home, needless to say, this kind of conversation is as important as it has ever been. And I am deeply appreciative of the two gentlemen who are joining me today on the morning show to talk about some of these important issues and matters. First of all, Richard Stein, who is Director of Law Enforcement Training here at Gateway Technical College, and Ray Clark, who is a halftime instructor in the Law Enforcement Academy. And we will be talking with both of them about these matters and more. Richard Stein, Ray Clark, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you for joining me for this this conversation. Ahead of us digging into some of the details and the nuts and bolts, I think it's important for our listeners to kind of know the story of each of you in terms of your own professional relationship to the field of law enforcement. Richard Stein, let's begin with you. Your professional background and the pathway that ultimately took you to your current position at Gateway.
Sure. So I started with the City of Milwaukee Police Department back in 1993 as a young recruit many, many years ago. In 2018, I retired from Milwaukee Police. I was the deputy director of their training academy. So Milwaukee Police has its own training academy. I retired there, and then I, 3 days later, started here with Gateway, took over Gateway's directorship of their training academy.
So
spent a lot of time in the field and almost coming on 2 years here.
Very good. Ray Clark, tell us who you are and what you have done ahead of beginning this particular relationship with Gateway.
Most certainly, Greg. I started in law enforcement in 1991. I'm still current in law enforcement. I'm actually the chief of police in the town of Ellivan right now. So I still stay current in law enforcement. I started teaching with Gateway about the year 2000. And I've been with Gateway as an adjunct all the way through two and a half years ago when I took a halftime position. I have been with Gateway since the inception of the academy. I've been teaching in the academy since we started the academy here. I teach EVOC, which is the driving portion. I'm also a constitutional law instructor. I teach constitutional law. And I administer all the scenario and integration exercise, which is the hands-on based training that they have.
Very good. From each of you, I would really be interested to know what drew you to this field in the first place. I mean, that drew each of you to want to become police officers. Richard Stein?
I kind of stumbled into it. I actually was going for an accounting degree because that was one of the easiest ways, well, one of the surest ways to get into the FBI, actually, was through accounting degree. But it turns out I don't like accounting, so I just finished with a regular business degree. And then at that time, Milwaukee Police was hiring. I was finishing up my undergrad at Marquette University. And so I kind of applied half on a whim. There was a hiring freeze at that time with Milwaukee. They had a little issue with Dahmer at that time, so everything got frozen. And then out of the blue, I got a call. They said, are you interested? And I was debating whether I wanted to take a desk job somewhere, and I decided, well, let's give this a whirl. And, I kind of stumbled into it, and it's very fortunate. I had a very varied career with Milwaukee Police, a lot of different assignments, a lot of different work experiences, a very rewarding career there with Milwaukee. I was very happy.
Very good. How about you, Ray Clark?
Going to be the corniness of saying that I did want to help people. I lived inner city Los Angeles. We moved back here to Kenosha when I was about 10, 9. My dad was an iron worker. Actually, he wanted me always to be an iron worker with him. I don't like heights, and I wasn't going up on those little beams. I admire everything he did and being what he did. But I always kind of wanted to do this. My family was, my dad was also, you know, military. I had asthma at the time, couldn't get into the military, and kind of just wanted to do something that was going to help and help the country, help the people. And for me, this kind of, I guess, was my natural progression to do something. I got into this and didn't know if this was even going to be for me. And I know it's going to be corny as well. My first constitutional law class, I loved it. Probably why I'm a constitutional law instructor now is just, we, you know, once I started hearing about the law and the fact that, you know what, you know, the Supreme Court interprets this and everything, it really piqued my interest in it. So
interesting.
That's kind of where I'm sitting.
So that aspect of the work, I suppose, involves things like reading someone their Miranda rights, which in and of itself would seem to be a relatively straightforward matter that probably I could even do, having watched enough cop shows on television. But I suspect that what you're talking about goes far beyond that really important but kind of simple principle.
Yes, most certainly. It's actually a little bit more complicated than most people realize as to when and where and how and what we do with Miranda rights. And I would caution everybody, don't get your policing off of the TV shows, because a lot of times that's wrong. But yes, it's way more complicated than that. And I think that that communication, just talking about it even right now, is pretty much what's key in this career. People, I think, who don't do this career need to understand as well why we do what we do and how we do what we do. And I think it's a little bit more eye-opening once you do.
I think, you know, just to piggyback on what Ray is saying, so his constitutional law component of the academy, just that, is 32 hours. And so that's almost a full credit worth of a course. And so, you know, the police academy is often, you know, you look at it, you see the cool stuff they do, right? The firearms or the defense and arrest tactics, the driving. But those tactical skills, that's only one third of the academy. The other two thirds are professional communication, it's con law, it's ethics, it's so many other different components that are a classroom that we're sending the recruits through. So, yeah, you know, the running and gunning stuff's the cool stuff, but that's actually the minority of the things that we train them.
I wonder if it is a little bit of an issue to help those who might be interested in entering Gateway's Law Enforcement Academy to understand that right from the start, that this is not like television, and that police work is not like either what you saw on Hill Street Blue reruns or Adam 12 reruns, to go back another generation. Right, yeah. Right.
You're dating us there a little bit.
Yeah.
We all know who that is.
Yeah, dating myself too. But I mean, but really and truly, I'm very curious to know when the typical prospective student walks in the door or first clicks on the mouse to reach out to the program, right at the outset, what needs to be said to kind of help people understand what kind of field they're really entering and what it really means to be a police officer in 2020.
And my take on it is, in order to get to the Law Enforcement Academy where we are, they have to have 60 college credits already. They can't just walk in and go into a law enforcement academy. State of Wisconsin says you have to have a minimum of 60 college credits to get in that, or be sponsored by a department. So you have to know, even if you're sponsored by a department, there you have a certain amount of time that they have to get those 60 college credits as well. So at this point, I would hope that they know, getting into it, what it is. When I taught in the criminal justice degree, that was some of the things. We have a class called Intro to Law, or Intro to Criminal Justice. And part of that class is explaining that, you know, our career in reality, is based mostly on communication and talking to people. The major big things that you see a lot of times are very minimal in what we do. Most officers very seldomly ever use their firearm. Most officers don't use a CEW, which is a taser, or OC, or all that stuff that they carry. They use that very rarely. Our talking is where we get our compliance, and we talk to people, and that's the majority of what we do. Am I correct, Rich?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting you say that, because the academy is broken into three phases, right? And it's just the way that the curriculum is written, actually, by the Law Enforcement Standard Board. So we, as technical colleges, we're authorized to teach the curriculum, and we bring our own instructors, we bring our own unique take on the coursework, but the coursework itself, right, is mandated. So phase one is almost all classroom. There's very little hands-on in phase one. So that's 6 weeks of classroom. And so the expectation right away, and we start with orientation from day one, is you're gonna sit there, and we take away their computers, we take away their phones. And the emphasis on listening, active listening, which means you're engaging, you're listening, you're able to repeat back what was told to you, and communicating. So we really stress to the recruits, when you're on break in the hallway, you will be respectful of the other students. You will engage them. Hey, how's it going today? Because the sooner we can get that engagement with the public into their mind and the ability to do it, the better off they're going to be. So we start from day one, basically teaching them this is a communication course for all intents and purposes. You're going to become a master degree level of constitutional law, professional communication, statutes, crimes, report writing's big, a lot of reports. That's 99% of what they do is going to be writing for the rest of their career. So it's important that we get these skills down before we even start moving on to the more tactical skills.
Maybe you could talk us through kind of the way the rest of the basic curriculum fills out then, once those 6 weeks of work in the classroom are done.
Sure. So we kind of, I know Ray likes to call it this. It's the crawl, walk, run. Okay, so the crawl phase is phase one. It is, hey, you're police officers, or you're going to be police officers, you're going to be deputies someday. So we lay the groundwork. So think police work 101. So we go everything from officer wellness has become a large part of our academy as well. So that includes not just your physical well-being, but your mental well-being, emotional intelligence. So you're able to communicate with people who are not pleased with you, but understand how to gauge in that communication. And that goes right into your communications, your common law, like you mentioned, ethics. So we talk a lot about ethical decision making. And just kind of the small things, a lot of report writing. What is a good police report look like? Right? Because your report is what you're gonna rely on 8-12 months later, when now you're testifying in court. Because your memory is going to be what your memory is. So it's important that we get the good basics of report writing down for their skills. And then we jump into phase two. In phase two, we go some more advanced professional communication. So now we're not just talking about communication. Now we're saying, how do we engage in those hards, right? How do we engage in difficult conversations? How do we diffuse situations with our voice, right? How do we use communication as a tool to diffuse situations? Ray has his advanced constitutional law, right? So now we're going a deeper dive. I'll let him talk more about that, but we go deeper into not just the Constitution but what does it mean, right? What do historical court results mean to us in law enforcement, and how does that tort affect us in the way that we perform our jobs and limit us in what we can do, and what those responsibilities are for the officers as well. They're granted immense powers by the people we serve, and what does that mean in the service of those people. And then we get into the fun stuff like firearms, emergency vehicle operations, tactical operations. So there is a lot in the phase two of now we've laid the groundwork for what you can do and how you can do it and why, what your obligations are, and you learn what your standing is and what you're legally entitled to do. Now we go into how do we do those? How do we perform those skills? We wrap up phase three, we circle right back. And so now we say we've laid the groundwork for police work. We've shown you the skills to do some of the tactical things. Now let's go even deeper. So now we're going into police work 201, right? The more advanced courses. We get into, we've had a little taste of tactical and both tactical, meaning the way you position yourselves, and tactical communication, the way you speak. And then we move into crisis intervention. How do we deal with people in emotional crisis? Right? What does that look like when you're dealing with someone who is not rational, and yet you still have to de-escalate that situation? Well, we've taught you how to talk, we've taught you how to stand. Well, let's put those together and execute that. So we round out after that, after we kind of go through that, we spend a lot of time on OWI. There's one thing you're gonna go to court on, it's OWI. Those always go to court. Spend a good 40 hours on just learning the basics of how do we determine, you know, the probable cause we need to arrest you for OWI and what that looks like. And we finish out with touching on sexual assault investigations, juvenile investigations, right? How do we handle investigating things with juveniles? Because those are very sensitive situations. So we've, again, laid the basic groundwork for communication. And now you're entering these very volatile situations where you're dealing with a victim who happens to be a child. How does that look like? Because that's going to be an entirely different situation. We wrap everything up then with scenario week. So scenario week is 40 hours long. There is a tested scenario at the end of it. The scenarios are our instructor's chance, and Ray can touch on it more, to take everything we've learned and we put them into real life, as real life situations as we can. And we say, here you go. We've given you the skills, knowledge, and abilities to do this. Go forth and show us.
Wow. That gives us a real sense not only of how thorough and comprehensive this kind of training is, but it also really gives us also a sense of just how complicated and challenging this work is once one has graduated and is out in the world. For those of you just joining us today on The Morning Show, I am speaking with Richard Stein, Director of Law Enforcement Training here at Gateway Technical College, and also with us is Ray Clark, who is not only chief of police for the town of Delavan, but also a halftime instructor in the Law Enforcement Academy here at Gateway. Ray Clark, let's talk a bit about what Richard Stein was touching on at the end, namely the incredibly important work that is involved in scenario training, in which all of this moves from the theoretical, it moves off the blackboard and into real life, and to real life scenarios that, by their very nature, are going to be, to some extent at least, unpredictable. And in many cases, officers are called upon to make what will be life and death decisions about use of force. And of course, these are matters that are as timely as can be. Before we talk about how you kind of train young people or students of whatever age in some of this, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about the way in which the training of officers has changed since, for instance, the beginning of your career. I mean, you began as a police officer in 1991. I add parenthetically the year of the Rodney King incident. So your career has been lived out during this time of in a sense, escalating turbulence and challenge. How has the training of law enforcement officers changed through the course of your career?
And Greg, that's an excellent question. You know, when I started, the academy was 320 hours long. Now we're at a 720-hour academy. We've added 400 hours since I started 30 years ago in the academy. When I started, the criteria for coming in was you had to be 18 years old and have a driver's license, and that was all you needed to be a police officer. You didn't have to have any college credits. You didn't have to have any, there wasn't much of a background / psychological evaluation. You didn't have to have a psychological at the time. Now we've changed a lot in law enforcement. You know, we've I don't want to use the word become more professional, but we are a professional organization and have evolved toward that professional, a higher professional standard as we kept going. Wisconsin happens to be one of the states that has one of the more advanced, or I guess in-depth training hours. We, like I said, have 720 hours. I don't know if we completely lead the country, but we're right up there on the amount of hours we offer in a training academy. The things that obviously in 320 hours you get versus 700 hours is, you know, astronomical different things. When I went through, communication was a thing. They used to call it, they were just starting to call it verbal judo, and I'm sure Richard probably remember when they called it verbal judo. Back in the days. And actually, that was kind of a brand new thing of us doing that. And it is involved into our professional communications, which is a sizable block in the academy of communicating with people. When I went through, they called the hands-on portion of RISC, not DAT, which DAT stands for Defense and Arrest Tactics. And there was some communication there, but it wasn't a lot of communication going there. Now we've molded that communication into the force. If they have to use force, that we need to communicate. All right, we have an intervention options in the state of Wisconsin, which is something that I know a lot of people looking for reform are calling for. Hey, we should have some type of force continuum. Wisconsin for years has had, they used to have what was called the force continuum. It's called intervention options now, which start with our mere presence is a use of force. Just when I show up there on a scene with this big uniform on and all my stuff, that's a use of force. Then it goes to our dialogue. Then it goes to control alternatives, which would be something like a taser or something like an OC spray or a come along hold. And then it goes to a protective alternative, which is something that is going to be a more like if I have to do some type of strike on you or use a baton. And then the last phase, the last level is deadly force. So we have these intervention options that they have to go through. So training has completely evolved in the last 30 years of my career. It's went in a very good way. You know, I don't want to stereotype the old 1970s, 80s cops, but you know, we don't need the big dumb cops that can just go out there. And I'm not, if you want to be rude to anybody, if you know anybody that was a police officer in the 70s, I'm not saying they were dumb. I mean, we don't need people that can just go out there and use force, because we have all of these tools now, these communication tools, these, you know, even with our control devices like tasers and stuff, we have these less lethal type of tools that we have to be able to control people better. It's more about dialogue. It's more about talking to people now. And that's what I've seen kind of evolve for our career.
So when we're talking about the training that occurs at Gateway in your academy, and I guess it's phase three, how is it that you create scenarios in which one of your students confronts a situation, something like they might confront out in the world, and where they're going to have to make choices in the moment about how do I de-escalate this difficult situation? I mean, what are the nuts and bolts of how you do this critically important work in the training process?
And to kind of tag on what we were just talking about a little bit before I answered that, I'm not going to not answer it. But the theoretical is wonderful. It's great to learn and book learn and see and know. But until you have to do something and think on your feet and do that, sometimes it doesn't click with people. And we're in a career where it is ever changing. Nothing is ever the same. The same incident I may go to today, I may go to the exact same two people doing the exact same, being called for the exact same thing tomorrow at the exact same time, and it's going to be a different incident. So nothing is ever status quo, or everything is changing. So it's a good question to say, why, what do we do? How do we bring this in? The state, I can't tell you exactly, because the state is kind of secretive on exactly what their scenario testings are. So I can't say that, because they will have actually an entire week, 4 days of practice scenarios, and then they have a testing scenario where they have to pass four scenarios at the very end. If they do not, they're going to be out of the academy, and they would have to take the entire 720-hour academy over again. Where we get the scenarios are the state has certain ones that are already set. We as a college can most certainly add on to them. Some of the things that I think Rich can will probably touch on in a little bit is, you know, we added on and made sure that, you know, there were an officer override type scenario in this one where you have to override an officer that is doing something that should not be doing something. Mm-hmm. It is our responsibility as law enforcement, whether it is me on the scene or whether it is one of my officers and I am doing something, for them to step in and go, hey, that's wrong, Chief. You need to not do that. All right. It is a 100% responsibility of each officer to do that. So we have a scenario in which we had in there that was an override where actually I played the role player. They know me as a chief there. They know me as this. So they know me as a person that's of authority. And they had to override what I was doing because what I was doing was wrong. We also have de-escalation scenarios. We have other scenarios built in that aren't exactly called de-escalation, but they do de-escalate. We have scenarios that involve people in some type of, it's a welfare check where they have some type of depression going on, all right, where they could be suicidal. They could not be suicidal. It depends. Our talking kind of gets to see what's going to happen with them. We have scenarios that involve traffic stops, obviously, because they're going to be dealing with traffic stops. We have scenarios that involve domestic situations and multiple different types of situations. We are kind of scripted by the state for certain scenarios, but we are allowed, and we've added time in. I got to commend the director in adding more time in, so we are allowed to have scenarios that are kind of extra than what the state has to kind of add on to that even more.
And do you utilize, I'll call them actors? I mean, who ends up playing the role of suspect or perpetrator or whatever we want to say, and how scripted are these scenarios? I mean, are they scripted down to the word?
So think of it as rails, right? So when a good scenario allows the officer to always succeed, so we're always going to drive a scenario towards success, but they have to get there on their own. So we want scenarios are kind of funny because you get the illusion that you've got free will and decision making, but they're very tightly written by us. And we, you know, Chief Clark does a great job. We brief before each one, we test each one, and everyone knows their place within a scenario. And the driver is that role player, right? That role player is the person that will drive that scenario to where it needs to go. The purpose of a scenario is not a gotcha, because that's the worst thing you could do. So, and it all comes down to, quite honestly, science. In a crisis, your brain, right, will refer to what it knows to act in a crisis. Because your adrenaline's pumping, you've got to make decisions at the speed of light, and it's very difficult. So scenarios are our best tool to give those recruits those pathways, those engrams in their brain, that they can refer to when they're in a crisis, and the brain can glob onto them and go. So we want that crisis response, right? To go back and to look at something successful and to grab onto it and use that. So our scenarios are designed for successful outcomes. Now they may not do it successfully, and that's okay. We're training. We need to learn the correct way to do it, right? And that's why we practice scenarios so much. And then that's another key feature. Other than in our tested scenarios, which are a different animal, failing is okay. This is the time to do it. This is the time to do it in scenarios. Hmm. You're learning the correct way to do it. And so we will guide you as best we can during the course of the scenario, and they're written specifically that way. And we've given them the tools to do the scenario correctly through the course of the instruction. Right? It's just we're now in that putting it all together phase. Hmm.
And to tag on to that, our role players they have to be by state standard trained. So they are trained role players. They actually are usually instructors that are there, and they know what their role is. When they go into a scenario, we have what's called an exercise control officer, who is there to run the exercise. They're making sure that nobody gets hurt. We had a safety officer there actually in every scenario just to make sure that everything is safe. Understand that we're making it as realistic as we can. So they will walk in with OC that's inert, which is basically water. They have a firearm on them that doesn't fire a real round, but fires a blank round. They have a baton on them that is made of plastic that they can, if they have to. They have a taser or an electronic control device that doesn't have a battery in it, so they can't. In order to do this, we have what's called triple checks. Everybody has to make sure that we don't want any training accidents. So when they go in, like Director Sines said, they come in to this scenario as if it was real, and these role players know what they're doing and know their part. So I hope that answers the question.
It does. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Richard Stein, Director of Law Enforcement Training at Gateway Technical College, and Ray Clark, who is a halftime instructor in the Law Enforcement Academy, and he also is Chief of Police for the town of Delavan. At the risk of asking you to make some difficult generalizations, I think it's important for us to ask when there are those instances in which a police officer or a law enforcement officer of any kind acts inappropriately. Typically, what has gone wrong in those moments where a police officer ends up making poor decisions in terms of use of force and so on? And I'm mostly asking that for the sake of what the two of you think about in terms of training future police officers, in terms of what are those points of maybe greatest danger or severest vulnerability that you hope you can address through the way you train your students going forward from here.
I can answer a little bit on that, I think. Let me start with, I believe that when we start talking about when we have some type of excessive force type issue, first and foremost, I would just ask everyone, please, before we make a judgment and a snap decision on anything, to make sure we have all the facts of the situation. That's what I would ask first. I can say this, that I've been a law enforcement officer for a long time. I know that a lot of people believe that all we do is stick up for other police. That's not true. I can tell you that during the incident with Mr. Floyd, that I don't know a police officer that went, hey, that was good. I think everybody went, that person, again, we need to see an entire totality of a situation, but if we do something wrong, we need to be held accountable just like anybody else. And I think that law enforcement understands that. I do believe, however, that we need to have all the facts before we decide at any time that this is not justified. And there are things that we do that I believe that people don't understand. This is what this whole communication is key, is a big thing, is I think we need to understand why we train what we train and how we train what we train and why the officer did what the officer did. That being said, if there is an issue of excessive force, we still, I hate to say this, are human, all right? Law enforcement still is human, we're human beings, and I'm not gonna say that there aren't issues of excessive force. When that happens, one of the things that I will say is, and we train this and we do this in the academy, is we know, like Director Stein said, that when you have some type of high stress situation and your adrenaline kicks in, you lose your cognitive thinking abilities, your fine motor skills, your upper level thinking, and you go back to revert to what's training. If that training was not done correctly, that could be what's called a training scar that we would have. And that could lead to something. If even the training was done correctly and you perceive something that's not a perception there and you act out of what you should act, that's your mind saying, this is what I need to do at this time a lot of times. And it's difficult for me to untrain that. I'm not in that situation, so I can't say, hey, I don't know what my mind, what this officer's mind was perceiving. It may be completely wrong, and they need to be punished, and things need to be go on, but I'm not in their mind at that time. So for me, I look at it as, if it's an excessive force type issue, then we should take it on a case basis and see why this person did this, what happened. Again, charge the officer, fire the officer, do what needs to be done if that needs to be done. All right, if it is indeed excessive force, and then every situation, maybe come back and look at that and go, hey, what can we train better, or can we even train better this? Or was it one officer doing something that they definitely shouldn't have done? I just look at our career as saying that I see as a chief, I do, and at least in my department, I can't speak for other departments, I can only speak for mine, that I wouldn't tolerate any type of, you know, bias things or any type of excessive force or anything like that. And we would terminate officers if we see that happening. And I feel that we do that when we see that happening.
Right. You know, and just to chime onto that too, when you come out of the academy, trained to do the best you can in those given situations, using the best tools and the best techniques that are available. Now, over time, what can happen is that training could be overridden if you're doing things incorrectly. And then that comes down to a level of supervision. And so one of the things, when I was with Milwaukee, we actually worked hand in hand with our internal affairs. They were in the same building. And so our in-service, when we brought the officers in the officers would come in every two to three times a year for their in-service training. And we would go over the things, you know, the trends that we would see. And generally speaking, and this is just generally speaking, officers get into trouble in that 7 to 11 years on the job mark, right? It's, you're on just long enough to think you know everything, but you haven't seen it. So generally when we do, and we would do these, we'd call them ethical autopsies. We would look at what happened, and not just the incident itself, but we would want to go back to the career of this officer that and see what were the warning signs we missed. And quite frankly, there's always warning signs, right? Very rarely do these type of incidents happen out of the blue where you're like, oh gosh, Fred was a great guy. I can't imagine that happened like that. Generally speaking, you could go back and you could see little incidents that led up to the big incident. So one of the things that especially in basic recruit academy training, is we try to prep them for that, right? We try to say, look, your agency will always get sued on two things, failure to supervise or failure to train, right? That's why you're here. You're here to train, and you're here to train and do it correctly. The training we give you is the legally defensible training that 7 to 10 years from now, you will fall back on and say, look, I did this particular thing the way I was trained, the way, you know, and yeah, it may not look nice. And unfortunately, anytime you use force, it's not going to look good. It's just the reality of the situation. But like Chief Clark was saying, when you look at the totality of the circumstances and what's in the officer's mind at the time use of force was employed, and that's another key to when you talk about the use of force. It isn't what a video shows that determines the officer's, you know, ability to use force. It's what's in that officer's mind at the time he determined force needed to be used. And was that reasonable? Okay. Did that officer have a reasonable fear for his safety or someone else's safety at the time use of force was applied? And that's the standard, right, that we need to think about too. Is a reasonable person in the same situation where they do the same thing? They have a reasonable fear for their safety. And so it's tough, especially from our level, because we'll look at these snippets of situations, and I think Chief Clark and I are the same. We were like, okay, that looks bad, but now show me everything, right? I need to know what was in that officer. I need to know what led up to that decision so I know whether he made a reasonable choice or not. So, and just giving me a snippet of a situation, unfortunately, yes, it's great in our current, you know, snippet world which we operate in, but it doesn't give us the context we need, right? To really look at that situation and go, is that good? Is that bad? It could go either way, you know, depending on, tell me what led up to it. So, you know, we look at that, you know, and as, God, that looks awful, right? But then we also understand, yeah, but what choice did he have? Let's go back, let's rewind the tape. Let's see, you know, let's see how the encounter started and what led up to the decision to use Flow.
Right. So in other words, it's about trying to understand the full situation, the full story. And once we know that full situation and story, it might still be the wrong choice that was made, but we know
you
that.
You go, whoa, what was that guy doing, right?
But we know that with more certainty. Ray Clark, I know we need to let you go in just a moment. Can I just have you touch briefly, and then we'll have Richard Stein follow up on the matter of race. And to what extent this is one of those markers that you watch for very carefully as you are training these young officers in terms of certain attitudes or biases that one would not want to bring into this kind of work?
Most certainly. And I think that any bias in this career shouldn't be tolerated. This is not a career of bias. I took an oath when I started 29 years ago. That oath still means something to me, which is to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, uphold the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin and the local rules and regulations of my jurisdiction. We as law enforcement cannot be biased in any way, shape, or form, whether it's on race, whether it's on sexual orientation, whether it's on culture, whether it's on religion, we can't. Our job is to protect this Constitution and to protect this country. And I will say this, if we find somebody who's biased, they shouldn't be here. We shouldn't have them. We should not have them in this career. They should be taken out of this career. This is not a career. If you want to be biased, well, not something where you're upholding the laws of the country should you be biased. And you can, maybe there's other careers that you could go do. We do, I think, a decent job right now. We do actually, in Wisconsin, I can only speak for Wisconsin again, so I know that when we start talking law enforcement nationally, Wisconsin leads in a lot of different things. We lead in training, and I'm not going to say we're the top, but we're up there in training. We're up there in hiring processes and different things we do. So I can only speak from our state's kind of criteria. For me, we do a background check, a full background check. We do a psychological evaluation on everyone that comes in. And if there's any characteristics in the psychological evaluation that's showing us any type of bias or anything that is any untrustworthiness, any bias, anything like that, they're eliminated from my process. Our background check is pretty thorough. I mean, they fill out almost a 35-page questionnaire, all right? And we go talk to everybody from neighbors to other employers and trying to find out exactly who the person is. An application is great, but most people are going to put people, their friends, on their application. I'm not going to put my neighbor that doesn't like me on my application. But if I go talk to the neighbor who doesn't like them, I can find out why the neighbor doesn't like them and what they may have said or other things. And we get people out of the career for that. I have always said that it is not a career that we should have any type of bias. And we touch on this so many different times in the academy. This was the first week of the new academy. It just came in. I've had them in constitutional law. We've already discussed this in constitutional law. You know, First Amendment of the Constitution guarantees us, you know, the right of freedom of religion right off the bat, the right to freedom of peacefully assemble, the right of freedom of speech. All right. And then we get to, you know, the due process under the 14th, and we talk about all these amendments and why we have them. I know that they have cultural competencies and ethics, and we talk about it in so many different classes. So the definitive answer, if you're asking me as a chief and as a police officer and as an instructor, is no, bias is not welcome in our career, nor should it be. And I think, and I can speak for every officer that I know that will agree with me, that it's not welcome here in this career. I will say Roughly, there are 600,000 law enforcement officers in this country right now. They are human, and again, do people slip through that probably are biased or racist or in some way? I'm going to say probably those officers should be terminated. They should not be allowed to be on their departments if they are. And I would hope whatever departments, if they found that they have an officer like that, would terminate them. But I do think that we in the academy really stress on that. Maybe Rich can touch a little bit more about that, but I think we really stress on this, the fact that we can't have any of these bias on anything at all. Rich, did you want to add? I'm sorry, Greg.
I was just going to say that touches on the heart and soul of the work that you do. It's like the last thing that should be in the mix. I think you said that very well. And I know you have a meeting to get to, so I want to...
I apologize to everybody, but I do have a meeting to get to.
Yep.
Thank you very much. If we want to do a follow-up at some time, I'm more than welcome to do so.
I appreciate that. Ray Clark, instructor for the Law Enforcement Academy at Gateway and police chief at the town of Delavan. Thank you for so much for being part of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both.
Thank you. Richard Stein, you're still with us. And just in our last minute or so, anything you want to...
Let me take what Ray talked about and kind of carry that ball a little further. So, and what Ray specifically, what Chief Clark is talking about is conscious bias, right? And that's what's not tolerated. We all have unconscious bias. We all have our, and that's just a fact of being human. And so I think the next level of training in law enforcement is, and this is what, I'm working, actually President Albert's been great about this. We're working at the next level, which is how do we deal with those unconscious bias? How do we identify them and how do we deal with them? Because everyone has them, right? You're human, you make observations and you make judgments on an individual based on your visual observations. It's just, that's part of being human. So, and those judgments are based on your upbringing, they're based on your experiences, all part of where you got to in this particular moment in time. So how do we in law enforcement, how do we identify those unconscious biases we have? And how do we then police knowing those biases and how do we overcome them and how do we ensure fair and equitable treatment of all of our citizens? And so I think law enforcement, and I know it doesn't feel like it, I think, but trust me, given the 25 years that I've been around, 28 years now, that we've done a really good job of eliminating those conscious bias type of situations. Where that next level is now more about the deeper level of understanding, right? Where does the person I'm dealing with come from? And how do I empathize? How do I identify with their situation? Still keep myself safe, still keep professional, but at the same time, I need to do a little better job, right, of understanding their take on the situation and how it differs from my take on the situation and find that happy medium. And so that's our next level that we're addressing. We do address it in the academy. We have fair and impartial policing. We do a little bit of procedural justice, but I think improving on those areas is our next real big goal.
Hmm. Very well said, and I appreciate all the information that you have shared in this conversation. For people who want more information about the law enforcement training that is offered by Gateway, I assume they can find just about anything they're interested in on Gateway's website?
Correct. Yeah, we have a website that kind of lists out the academy and the requirements for it. We also do obviously have the associate degree program as well, the criminal justice associate degree program, which is separate from my area, but it also touches on a lot of these aspects as well.
Very good. So to gtc.edu for more information. Richard Stein is Director of Law Enforcement Training here at Gateway Technical College. Richard Stein, I deeply appreciate you making the time in your schedule to be part of the morning show and to be part of this important conversation. Thank you so much and best wishes with the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.